George W. Bush promised us a foreign policy with humility. Instead, he has brought us humiliation in the eyes of the world. He promised to restore honor and integrity to the White House. Instead, he has brought deep dishonor to our country and built a durable reputation as the most dishonest president since Richard M. Nixon. Honor? He decided to no longer honor the Geneva Conventions. Just as he would not honor the opinion and experience of people who have been involved with the military, just as he would not honor the United Nations international treaties, the opinions of our allies, the role of Congress and the courts, or what Jefferson described as a decent respect for the opinion of mankind. He did not honor the judgment of our military leaders in designing his invasion of Iraq, and now he will not honor our fallen dead by attending any funerals or by even permitting any photos of their flag-draped coffins. How did we get to where we are? How did we get from September 12, 2001, when a leading French newspaper ran a giant headline with the words, "We are all Americans now," a time when we had the goodwill and empathy of all the world, to now, to the horror that we all felt in witnessing the pictures of torture at Abu Ghraib? Well, to begin with, from its earliest days in power, this administration sought to radically destroy the foreign policy consensus that had guided America since the end of World War II. The long successful strategy of containment was abandoned in favor of the new experimental strategy that they called preemption, and what they meant by preemption was not the inherent right of any nation to act preemptively against an imminent threat to its national security, but rather an exotic new approach that asserted a unique and unilateral U.S. right to ignore international law whenever it wished to do so, and to launch military action against any nation, even in circumstances where there was no imminent threat. All that is required in the view of the Bush team is the mere assertion of a possible future threat, and the assertion need be made by only one person, the president. More disturbing still was their frequent use of the word dominance to describe their strategic goal. Disturbing because an American policy of dominance is as repugnant to the rest of the world as the ugly pictures of dominance of those helpless, naked Iraqi prisoners has been to the people of our country. Dominance is as dominance does. Dominance is not really a strategic policy or political philosophy at all. It is rather a seductive illusion that tempts the powerful to satiate their hunger for still more power by striking a Faustian bargain. And as always happens, sooner or later, to those who shake hands with the devil, they find out too late that what they have given up in the bargain is their soul. One of the clearest indications of the impending loss of intimacy with one's soul is the failure to recognize the existence of a soul in those over whom power is being exercised, especially if the helpless especially if the helpless come to be dehumanized and treated as animals and degraded. We also know, and not just from Desaad and Freud, the psychological proximity between sexual depravity and other people's pain. It has been especially shocking and awful to see these paired evils perpetrated so crudely and cruelly in the name of the United States of America. Those pictures of torture and sexual abuse came to us embedded in a wave of news about escalating casualties and growing chaos enveloping our entire policy in Iraq. But in order to understand the failure of our overall policy, I believe it is important to focus specifically on what exactly happened in Abu Ghraib prison and ask whether or not those actions were representative of who we are as Americans. Obviously, the quick answer is no. But unfortunately, it's more complicated than that. There is good and evil in every person. And what makes the United States special in the history of nations is our commitment to the rule of law and our carefully constructed system of checks and balances. Our natural distrust of concentrated power and our devotion to openness and democracy are what have led us as a people to consistently choose good over evil in our collective aspirations more than the people of any other nation. Our founders were insightful students of human nature. They feared the abuse of power because they understood that every human being has not only better angels in his or her nature, but also an innate vulnerability to temptation, especially the temptation to abuse power over others. Our founders understood full well that a system of checks and balances is needed in our Constitution because every human being lives every day with an internal system of checks and balances that cannot be relied upon to produce virtue if they are allowed to attain an unhealthy degree of power over their fellow citizens. Listen then to the balance of internal impulses described by one of those accused of abusing prisoners, Specialist Charles Grainer, when he was confronted by one of his colleagues, Specialist Joseph M. Darby, who later became a courageous whistleblower. And pardon my language as I quote to Grainer, when Darby asked Grainer to explain the actions that Darby had discovered on the photo disc, Grainer replied, and I quote, "The Christian in me says it's wrong, but the corrections officer says I love to make a grown man piss on himself." What happened at that prison, it is now clear, was not the result of random acts by a few bad apples. It was the natural consequence of the Bush administration policy that has dismantled those wise constraints and made war on America's system of checks and balances and accountability and responsibility for action. The abuse of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib flowed directly from the abuse of the truth that characterized the administration's march to war and the abuse of the trust that had been placed in President Bush by the American people in the aftermath of September 11th. There was then, there is now, and there would have been, regardless of what President Bush did, a threat of terrorism that we would have to deal with. But instead of making it better, he has made it worse. We are less safe because of his policies. He has created more anger and righteous indignation against us as Americans than any leader of our country in the 228 years of our existence as a nation. And it is because of his attitude of contempt for any person, institution, or nation who disagrees with him. He has exposed Americans abroad and Americans in every U.S. town and city to a greater danger of attack by terrorists because of his arrogance, willfulness, and bungling at stirring up hornets' nests that posed no threat whatsoever to us. And by then insulting the religion and culture and tradition of people in other countries. And by pursuing policies that have resulted in the deaths of thousands of innocent men, women, and children, all of it done in our name. President Bush said in his speech Monday night that the war in Iraq is the central front in the war on terror. It's not the central front in the war on terror, but it has unfortunately become the central recruiting office for terrorists. I remember when Vice President Cheney said that this war may last for the rest of our lives. Well, the unpleasant truth is that President Bush's utter incompetence has made the world a far more dangerous place and dramatically increased the threat of terrorism against the United States of America. It is unfortunate, but it is true. Just yesterday, the International Institute of Strategic Studies reported that the Iraq conflict, and I quote them, has arguably focused the energies and resources of Al-Qaeda and its followers while diluting those of the Global Counterterrorism Coalition. The ISS said that in the wake of the war in Iraq, Al-Qaeda now has more than 18,000 potential terrorists scattered around the world, and the war in Iraq is swelling the ranks of terrorists. The war plan was incompetent in its rejection of the advice from military professionals, and the analysis of the intelligence was incompetent in its conclusion that our soldiers would be welcomed with garlands of flowers and cheering crowds. That was one of the reasons they felt like they did not need to pay attention to or respect the so-called Powell Doctrine of overwhelming force. There was also, in Secretary Rumsfeld's planning, a failure to provide security for nuclear materials and to prevent widespread lawlessness and looting. Luckily, there was a high level of competence on the part of our soldiers, even though they were denied the tools and the numbers they needed for their mission. But what a disgrace that their families have to hold bake sales to buy discarded Kevlar vests so the soldiers can stuff them into the floorboards and sides of the Humvees that they have to ride around in without any armor. Bake sales for body armor. What kind of policy is that? And the worst still lies ahead. Don't take my word for this. Listen to what General Joseph Hoar, the former head of the U.S. Marine Corps, says. He told Congress the other day, and I quote, "I believe we are absolutely on the brink of failure. We are looking into the abyss." Well, let me tell you, when a senior, respected military leader like Joe Hoar uses the word abyss, then the rest of us damn well better sit up and listen. Here's what he means. More American soldiers dying. Iraq slipping into more chaos and violence. No end in sight, with America's influence and moral authority seriously damaged. Retired Marine Corps General Anthony Zinni, who headed the Central Command before becoming President Bush's personal emissary to the Middle East, said recently that our nation's current course in Iraq is, and I'm quoting him, headed over Niagara Falls, end quote. The White House spokesman Dan Bartlett was asked the other morning on live television about these scathing condemnations by generals involved in the highest levels of the Pentagon. And he said, well, they're retired, and we take our advice from active duty officers. But, amazingly, even active duty military officers are speaking out against President Bush's policies. For example, the Washington Post quoted a senior general at the Pentagon, unnamed, as saying, and I quote, "The current Office of the Secretary of Defense refused to listen or adhere to military advice." The commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, Army Major General Charles Swanick, Jr., asked by the Post whether he believes the U.S. is losing the war in Iraq, replied, "I think strategically we are." Army Colonel Paul Hughes, who directed strategic planning for the occupation authority in Baghdad, compared what he sees in Iraq to the Vietnam War, where he lost his brother. And he said this, "I promised myself when I came on active duty that I would do everything in my power to prevent that from happening again." And he noted the pattern in Vietnam of winning battles and then losing the war. And then he added, and I quote, "Unless we ensure that we have coherence in our policy, we will lose strategically." The Post also quoted an unnamed general as saying, in his words, "Like a lot of senior Army guys, I'm quite angry with Rumsfeld and the rest of the administration." He listed two reasons. He said, "I think they're going to break the Army." And he said, "What really gets him mad is, I don't think they care." In his upcoming book, General Zinni blames the current catastrophe on the Bush team's incompetence early on. Here's what he wrote, quote, "In the lead up to the Iraq war and its later conduct, I saw at a minimum true dereliction, negligence, and irresponsibility, at worst lying, incompetence, and corruption," end quote. Zinni's book will join a growing library of volumes by former advisors to Bush. Richard Clark, his principal advisor on terrorism. Paul O'Neill, his principal economic policy spokesman and advisor. Former Ambassador Joe Wilson, who was honored by President Bush's father for his service in Iraq. And former domestic advisor on faith-based organizations, John DiIulio, who said this, and again I quote here, "There is no precedent in any modern White House for what is going on in this one. A complete lack of a policy apparatus. What you have got is everything, and I mean everything, run by the political arm. It is the reign of the Mayberry Machiavellis." I'm just quoting the close advisors who worked right with him. In February of 2002, before the war began, Army Chief of Staff General Eric Shinseki told Congress that the occupation could require several hundred thousand troops, but Rumsfeld and Bush didn't want to hear that because they were convinced they knew more than he did and they could do it more cheaply, and so they hushed him up and then forced him out of the military. In any case, as a direct result of the incompetent planning and inadequate troop strength, young soldiers were put in an untenable position. For example, young reservists assigned to the Iraqi regiments were called up without training or adequate supervision and then instructed by superiors from organizations not in their chain of command to, quote, break down prisoners in order to prepare them for interrogation. They were placed in a confusing situation where the chain of command was crisscrossed between intelligence gathering and prison administration, and further confused by an unprecedented mixing of military and civilian contractor authority. The soldiers who are accused of committing these atrocities are, of course, responsible for their own actions, and if found guilty, must be severely and appropriately punished. But they're not the ones primarily responsible for the disgrace that has been brought upon the United States of America. They're not the ones who designed the policy and put it in place. Private Lindy England did not make the decision that the United States would no longer observe the Geneva Conventions. Specialist Charles Grainer was not the architect of the American gulag of dark rooms with cold, naked prisoners to be stressed and even, we must use the word tortured, to force them to say things that legal procedures might not induce them to say. These policies were designed and insisted upon by the Bush White House. Indeed, the president's own legal counsel briefed him, advised him specifically on the subject. His Secretary of Defense and the Assistant Secretaries of Defense pushed these cruel departures from historic American standards over the objections of the uniformed military. The judge advocates general within the Defense Department were so disturbed and so upset and so opposed to this policy that they took the unprecedented step of coming as a group to seek the help of a private attorney here in this city who specializes in human rights. And as a group, they said to him, quote, there is a calculated effort to create an atmosphere of legal ambiguity where the mistreatment of prisoners is concerned. Indeed, the secrecy of the program indicates an understanding on the part of its authors that the regular military culture and mores would not support these activities, and neither would the American public or the world community. That's why they tried to keep it secret. Another implicit acknowledgement of violations of accepted standards of behavior is the process of farming out prisoners to countries less averse to torture and giving assignments to private contractors who are accountable, apparently, to no one. President Bush himself set the tone for our attitude towards suspects in his State of the Union address in 2003. You may remember this. He noted that more than 3,000 suspected terrorists had been arrested in many countries, and then he added, and many others have met a different fate. Let's put it this way. They are no longer a problem to the United States and our friends and our allies. Did you react to that the way I did? He promised to change the tone in Washington, and indeed he did. Tragically, as many as 37 prisoners may have been murdered while in captivity, though the numbers are difficult to rely upon because in many cases involving violent death, there were no autopsies. How dare they blame their misdeeds on young enlisted personnel from a reserve unit in upstate New York? How dare they say this is the work of a few bad apples among enlisted personnel? President Bush owes more than one apology. On the list of those he let down are the young soldiers who are themselves apparently culpable, but who were clearly forced to wade into a moral cesspool designed by the Bush White House. The perpetrators, as well as the victims, were both placed in their relationship to one another by the policies of George W. Bush. How dare the incompetent and willful members of this Bush-Cheney administration humiliate our nation and our people in the eyes of the world and in the conscience of our own people? How dare they subject us to such dishonor and disgrace? How dare they drag the good name of the United States of America through the mud of Saddam Hussein's torture prison? Everybody makes mistakes, but this is more than a mistake. In fact, in this case, David Kay concluded his search for weapons of mass destruction in Iraq with the famous verdict, "We were all wrong." And for many Americans, Kay's statement seemed to symbolize the awful collision between reality and all of the false and fading impressions that President Bush had fostered in building support for his policy of going to war. And now the White House has informed the American people that they were also all wrong about their decision to place their faith in Ahmed Chalabi, even though they've paid him $340,000 per month and put him adjacent to the First Lady for the State of the Union address. He had been convicted of fraud and embezzling $70 million in public funds from a Jordanian bank and escaped serving a prison sentence by fleeing the country. But in spite of that record, he had become one of the key advisors to the Bush administration on planning and promoting the war against Iraq. They repeatedly cited him as a trusted authority and perhaps even a future president of Iraq. Incredibly, they even ferried him and his private army into Baghdad in advance of others and allowed him to seize control over Saddam's secret papers, which he apparently is now refusing to return. Now, after all of that, now the Bush White House is telling the American people that, oops, he was a spy for Iran who has been duping the President of the United States for the last 3.5 years. Kind of builds your confidence, doesn't it? Who knows what's going to happen next? One of the generals that they put in charge of this war policy went on a speaking tour in his spare time to declare before conservative evangelical groups that our nation is in a holy war as a, quote, Christian nation battling Satan. This same General Boykin was the person who ordered the officer in charge of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay to extend his stressful methods to the detainees and prisoners in Iraq. The testimony from those prisoners is that they were forced to curse their religion. General Zinni said, "We're now being viewed as the modern crusaders, as the modern colonial power in this part of the world." Of course, President Bush used the word crusade early on, and then when it was pointed out to be singularly inappropriate, a few weeks later he used it again. What a terrible irony that our country, which was founded by refugees seeking religious freedom, would now be responsible for this kind of abuse. One of these prisoners told a newspaper reporter that he was ordered to denounce Islam, and then after his leg was broken, one of his torturers started hitting it and, quote, ordered me to thank Jesus that I am alive. Others reported they were forced to eat pork and drink alcohol in violation of their religious beliefs. In my religious tradition, I have been taught in the book of Matthew, and I quote, "Ye shall know them by their fruits. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree bringeth forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree bringeth forth evil fruit. Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them." The president convinced a majority of the country that Saddam Hussein was responsible for attacking us on September 11th, when in truth he had nothing whatsoever to do with it. The president convinced the country by relying on a mixture of documents that turned out to be forged and blatantly false assertions that Saddam was in league with al-Qaeda and that he was, in the president's word, indistinguishable from Osama bin Laden. He asked the nation in his State of the Union address to imagine how terrified we should be that Saddam was about to give nuclear weapons to terrorists, and then stated repeatedly that Iraq posed a grave and gathering threat to our nation. He planted the seeds of war, he harvested a whirlwind, and now the corrupt tree of a war waged on false premises has brought us the evil fruit of Americans torturing and sexually humiliating prisoners who are helpless in their care. We have an election coming up, and in my opinion, John Kerry is dealing with this unfolding tragedy in an impressive and extremely responsible way. I believe that our nation's best interest lies in having a new president who can turn a new page, sweep clean with a new broom, take office on January 20th of next year with the ability to make a fresh assessment at that time of exactly what our nation's strategic position is at that time when the reins of power are finally wrested from the group of incompetents that have created this catastrophe for America. I do not believe that John Kerry should tie his own hands by offering overly specific, detailed proposals concerning a situation that is rapidly changing and unfortunately rapidly deteriorating, but should rather preserve his and our country's options to retrieve our national honor as soon as this long national nightmare is over. General Dwight Eisenhower, who campaigned during the terrible time of 1952 when the Korean War felt like a quagmire, did not propose a five-point plan for tweaking America's approach. Instead, he said, I will go to Korea. It is responsible and in the best interest of our nation to have a new president who is capable of assessing the situation when he takes the oath of office. And you know, when a business enterprise finds itself in deep trouble that is linked to the failed policies of the current CEO, well, the directors and stockholders usually say to the failed CEO, thank you very much, but we're going to replace you now with a new CEO, one who is less vested in a stubborn insistence on staying the course. One of the strengths of democracy is the ability of the people to regularly demand changes in leadership and to fire a failing leader and hire a new one who offers the promise of hopeful change. That is the real solution to America's quagmire in Iraq. But I am keenly aware that we have 7 months and 25 days remaining in this president's current term of office, which represents a time of dangerous vulnerability for our country because of the recklessness and demonstrated incompetence of the current administration. It is therefore essential that even as we focus on that fateful choice in November, we must simultaneously search for ways to reduce the extraordinarily high level of danger that we face with this current leadership team in place. It is for that reason that I am calling today for Republicans as well as Democrats to join me in asking for the immediate resignations of those immediately below George Bush and Dick Cheney who are responsible, most responsible for creating the catastrophe that we are facing in Iraq. We desperately need a national security team with at least minimal competence. I'm dead serious. Because the current team is making things worse with each passing day. They are endangering the lives of our soldiers and sharply increasing the danger faced by American citizens everywhere in the world, including here at home. They are enraging hundreds of millions of people and embittering an entire generation of anti-Americans whose anger is already near the boiling point. We simply cannot afford to further increase the risk to our country with more blunders by this team. Donald Rumsfeld ought to resign immediately as the chief architect of this plan. Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, the intelligence chief, Stephen Cambone, all ought to resign immediately. Our nation is at risk every single day Rumsfeld remains as Secretary of Defense. We need someone with good judgment and common sense. Condoleezza Rice ought to resign immediately. She has badly mishandled the coordination of national security policy. This is a disaster for our country. And they are responsible along with the president and vice president. We may have to wait to get rid of Bush and Cheney, but we ought to call on our Republican friends to join us in getting the rest of that team out right now. I want to say a special word about George Tenet, who I also believe should resign. I say that I want to offer a special word because he is a personal friend and I know him to be a good and decent and honorable man. It is especially painful for me to call for the resignation of a friend and a person I respect. But I have regretfully concluded that it is also important, extremely important, that our country have new leadership at our intelligence community immediately. As a nation, our greatest export has always been hope. Hope that through the rule of law, people can be free to pursue their dreams, that democracy can supplant suppression, and that justice, not power, will be the guiding force in society. Our moral authority in the world is derived from that hope anchored in the rule of law. With this blatant failure to respect the rule of law at the hands of the very agents of our government, we now face a great challenge in restoring America's moral authority in the world and demonstrating our commitment to bringing a better life to our global neighbors. During the presidency of Ronald Reagan, Secretary of Labor Ray Donovan was accused of corruption, but eventually, after a lot of publicity, the indictment was thrown out by the judge. Donovan asked the question, "Where do I go to get my reputation back?" President Bush has now placed the United States of America in that same situation. Where do we go to get our good name back? The answer is, we go where we always go when a dramatic change is needed. We go to the ballot box, and we make it clear to the rest of the world that what has been happening in America for the past 3.5 years and what America has been doing in Iraq for the last 2 years really is not who we are. We as a people, at least the overwhelming majority of us, do not endorse the decision to dishonor the Geneva Conventions and the Bill of Rights in our Constitution. Make no mistake, though, the damage done at Abu Ghraib is not only to America's reputation and America's strategic interests, but also to America's spirit. It is crucial for our nation to recognize, and recognize quickly, that the damage done is far more serious than President Bush's belated and tepid response would lead people to believe. Remember how shocked each of us individually was when we first saw those hideous images. The natural tendency was to at first recoil from the images and then to assume that they represented a strange and rare aberration that came about because of a few twisted minds, or, as the Pentagon said, a few bad apples. But as today's shocking news reaffirms yet again, this was not rare, and it was not an aberration. Today's New York Times reports that an Army survey of prisoner deaths and mistreatment in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I quote, show a widespread pattern of abuse involving more military units than previously known. Nor did these abuses spring from a few twisted minds at the lowest ranks of our military enlisted personnel. No, it came from twisted values and atrocious policies at the highest level of our government. This was done by our leaders in our name. These horrors were the predictable consequence of policy choices that flowed directly from this administration's contempt for the rule of law. And the dominance they have been seeking is truly not just unworthy of America, it also is an illusory goal in its own right. Our world is unconquerable because the human spirit is unconquerable. And any national strategy based on pursuing the goal of domination is doomed to fail because it generates its own opposition and in the process creates enemies for the would-be dominator. specifically, in this case, a policy based on domination of the rest of the world not only creates enemies for the United States and creates recruits for Al-Qaeda, it also undermines the international cooperation that is essential to defeating the efforts of those terrorists who wish to harm and intimidate Americans. Unilateralism, as we have painfully seen in Iraq, is its own reward. Going it alone may satisfy a political instinct, but it is dangerous to our military, even without their commander-in-chief taunting terrorists to bring it on. Our troops are stretched thin and exhausted, not only because Secretary Rumsfeld contemptuously dismissed the advice of military leaders on the size of the needed force, but also because President Bush's contempt for traditional allies and international opinion left us without a real coalition to share the military and financial burden of the war and the occupation. And actually, our future is dependent upon increasing cooperation and interdependence in a world tied ever more closely together by technologies of communication and travel. Make no mistake, it is precisely our moral authority that is our greatest source of strength, and it is precisely our moral authority that has been recklessly put at risk by the cheap calculations and mean compromises of conscience wagered with history by this willful president. Listen to the way Israel's highest court dealt with a question similar to the one we now face, back when in 1999 it was asked to balance the rights of individual prisoners against dire threats to the security of its people. Here is what they said, quote, "This is the destiny of democracy, as not all means are acceptable to it and not all practices employed by its enemies are open before it. Although a democracy must often fight with one hand tied behind its back, it nonetheless has the upper hand. Preserving the rule of law and the recognition of individual liberty constitutes an important component in its understanding of security. At the end of the day, these add to its strength." The last and best description of America's meaning in the world, relevant to our trial today, is still the definitive formulation of Lincoln's message to Congress in December of 1862. He said, "The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We shall nobly save or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just. A way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud and God must forever bless." It is now clear that the abuses of the truth and the unforgivable abuse of trust after 9/11 led to the problems in that prison. And we are now learning that there were similar problems in many other facilities constructed as part of a Bush gulag in which, according to the Red Cross, up to 70 to 90% of the people are innocent of any wrongdoing. The same dark spirit of domination has led them, for the first time in American history, to imprison American citizens with no charges, no right to see a lawyer, no right to notify their family, to know of what they are accused, to gain access to any court, to present an appeal of any sort. They have even acquired the power to compel librarians to tell them what you are reading, and to compel the librarians to be silent about the request, lest the librarians themselves be also imprisoned. They've launched an unprecedented assault on civil liberties, on the right of the courts to review their actions, on the right of the Congress to have information on how the public's money is being spent, and the right of the news media to have information about the policies that they are pursuing. This same pattern characterizes virtually all of their policies. They resent any constraint as an insult to their will to dominate and to exercise power. And their appetite for power is astonishing. It has led them to introduce a new level of viciousness in partisan politics. It was that which led them to attack as unpatriotic Senator Max Cleland, who lost three limbs in combat during the Vietnam War. This president episodically poses as a uniter and healer. If he really has any desire to play that role, then I call upon him to condemn Rush Limbaugh, perhaps his strongest political supporter, who said publicly that the torture in Abu Ghraib was a brilliant maneuver, and that the photos were good old American pornography, and that the actions portrayed were simply those of people having a good time and needing to blow off steam. This new political viciousness by the president and his supporters is found not only on the campaign trail, but in the daily operations of our democracy. They have insisted, for example, that the leaders of their party in Congress deny Democrats any meaningful role in shaping legislation or even to attend the all-important conference committees that decide the final shape of legislation passed by the Congress. The same meanness of spirit shows up in domestic policies, including in the Patriot Act, under which Muslims, innocent of any crime, were picked up and sometimes physically abused and held incommunicado indefinitely. What happened in Abu Ghraib was then a difference not of kind, but of degree. Now, differences of degree are important when the subject is torture. The apologists for what has happened do have points that should be heard and clearly understood. It is a fact that every culture and every politics sometimes expresses itself in cruelty. It is also undeniably true that other countries have and do torture more routinely and far more brutally than has ours. George Orwell once characterized life in Stalin's Russia as a, quote, boot stamping on a human face forever, end quote. That was the ultimate culture of cruelty, so ingrained, so organic, so systematic, that everyone in it lived in terror, even the terrorizers. And that was the nature and degree of state cruelty in Saddam Hussein's Iraq. We know these things, and we need not reassure ourselves and should not congratulate ourselves that our society is less cruel than some others, although it is worth noting that there are many that are less cruel than ours. And this searing revelation at Abu Ghraib should lead us to examine more thoroughly the routine horrors in our own domestic prison system. But what we do now in reaction to Abu Ghraib will determine a great deal about who we are at the beginning of the 21st century. It is important to note that just as the abuses of the prisoners flowed directly from the policies of the Bush White House, those policies in turn flowed not only from the instincts of the president and his advisors, they also found support in shifting attitudes on the part of some in our country in response to the outrage and fear generated by the attack of September 11th. The president exploited and fanned those fears, but some otherwise sensible and level-headed Americans fed them as well. I remember reading genteel-sounding essays asking publicly whether or not the prohibitions against torture were any longer relevant or desirable. The same grotesque misunderstanding of what is really involved in torture was responsible for the tone in the memo from the president's legal advisor, Alberto Gonzalez, who wrote on January 25, 2002, that the attack of 9/11, quote, renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions. Now we have seen the pictures. We have learned the news. We cannot unlearn it. It is part of us. So the important question now is, what will we do now about torture in our name? Stop it? Yes, of course. But that means demanding all of the facts, not covering them up, as some now charge the administration is doing. One of the whistleblowers at Abu Ghraib, Sergeant Samuel Provance, told ABC News a few days ago that he was being intimidated and punished for telling the truth. Quote, "There is definitely a cover-up. I feel like I am being punished for being honest," he said. In closing, the abhorrent acts in this prison were a direct consequence of the culture of impunity encouraged, authorized, and instituted by Bush and Rumsfeld in their statements that the Geneva Conventions did not apply. The apparent war crimes that took place were the logical, inevitable outcome of policies and statements from the administration. To me, just as glaring as the evidence of this was in the pictures themselves, was the revelation that it was established practice for prisoners to be moved around during the visits of the International Committee of the Red Cross so that they would not be available for interviews. Now, no one can claim that was the act of a few bad apples. That was policy set from above with the direct intent to violate U.S. values that they were claiming to uphold. This was the kind of policy that we see and criticize in places like China and Cuba. Moreover, the administration now has also set up the men and women of our own armed forces for payback the next time they are held as prisoners. And for that, the administration should pay a very high price. Moreover, one of the most tragic consequences of these official crimes is that it will be very hard for any of us as Americans, at least for a very long time, to effectively stand up for human rights elsewhere and criticize other governments when our policies have resulted in our soldiers behaving so monstrously. This administration has shamed America and has deeply damaged the cause of freedom and human rights everywhere, thus undermining the core message of America to the world. President Bush offered a brief and half-hearted apology to the Arab world, but he should apologize to the American people for abandoning the Geneva Convention. He also owes an apology to the United States Army for cavalierly sending them into harm's way while ignoring the best advice of their commanders. And perhaps most importantly of all, he should apologize to all of those men and women throughout our world who have held high the ideal of the United States of America as a shining goal to inspire their own hopeful efforts to bring about justice under a rule of law in their lands. They are due an apology from this President of the United States. Of course, the problem with all these requests is that a sincere apology requires an admission of error, a willingness to accept responsibility, and to hold people accountable. And President Bush is not only unwilling to acknowledge error, he has thus far been unwilling to hold anyone in his administration accountable for the worst strategic and military miscalculations and mistakes in the entire history of the United States of America. He is willing only to to apologize for the alleged erratic behavior of a few low-ranking enlisted people who he is scapegoating for his policy fiasco. In December of 2000, even though I strongly disagreed with the decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to order a halt in the counting of legally cast ballots, I saw it as my duty to reaffirm my own strong belief that we are a nation of laws, and then not only accept the decision, but do what I could to prevent efforts to delegitimize George Bush as he took the office of president. I did not at that moment imagine that Bush would, in the ensuing presidency, demonstrate utter contempt for the rule of law and work at every turn to frustrate accountability in the exercise of power. And so, today, I want to speak on behalf of those Americans who feel that President Bush has betrayed our nation's trust, those who are horrified at what has been done in our name, and all those who want the rest of the world to know that we Americans see the abuses that occurred in the prisons of Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo and secret locations as yet undisclosed as completely out of keeping with the character and basic nature of the American people and at odds with the principles on which America stands. I believe that we have a duty to hold President Bush accountable, and I believe we will. As Lincoln said at our time of greatest trial, we here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. Thank you. Thank you.